Imagine waking up one morning and realizing that the country you've relied on for your energy, well, they're suddenly threatening to turn off the tap.
Right, just completely cut you off.
Exactly. And the country you depend on for your physical defense is questioning the alliance. And the country manufacturing literally all your critical tech might restrict exports.
It's a terrifying scenario to even think about.
It really is. I mean, your power grid, your borders, your medicine cabinet, all of it outsourced. And all of it suddenly at risk. And the wild part is, in 2015, that wasn't just some hypothetical doomsday scenario for Europe.
No, not at all. That was the beginning of an incredibly harsh new reality.
Yeah, so welcome to today's deep dive, everyone. We are doing a sort of geopolitical autopsy today, looking at the years between 2015 and 2029. And we're diving into a very specific, really fascinating source document.
Yes, we're looking at a section of the dossier Trump 2015-2029.
Which is such an interesting paradox right off the bat, because, you know, it's called the Trump dossier, specifically Chapter 18. But the focus of this chapter actually isn't on the United States at all.
Right. It's entirely focused on Europe. It analyzes how those specific years and the shifting political winds in the U.S. forced an entire continent to completely rewire how it operates.
Which is what we're going to unpack today.
Yeah.
Our mission here is to go through the 10 critical lessons Europe was basically forced to learn during this period.
It really was a systemic shock. If you look at the baseline assumptions of European strategy from the end of the Cold War right up until that mid-2010s mark, there was this profound, almost intoxicating comfort.
Yeah, like everyone was just kind of asleep at the wheel.
Exactly. There was this widespread belief that the international order was just permanently stable. The working theory was that massive economic interdependence practically guaranteed peace.
Like, if we all trade together, nobody is going to start a war.
Right. And they also assumed that liberal democracy was the final, unchangeable destination of modern societies. Then, over the course of about a decade and a half, every single one of those foundational pillars was stress tested.
Stress tested to the point of structural failure, honestly.
Yeah, pretty much.
So, okay, let's unpack this. Because looking back at that era, it's not just a history lesson. Think of the past few years not just as history, but as a survival manual for the 21st century. What can you and an entire continent learn from it?
It really is an operator's manual for how a massive, complex society survives in a highly volatile world.
So let's start with lesson one. This is the foundation of Western society, democracy itself. And the sources reveal that our baseline assumptions were pretty fundamentally flawed.
Very flawed. The source talks about the vulnerability of democracy.
Yeah, because for a really long time, Europe basically treated democracy like a finish line. You know what I mean? Like, you run the race, you draft a constitution, you hold a free election, you cross the ribbon, and you're done.
The whole end of history mindset. It was a very seductive idea in the 1990s.
Right, you just coast after that.
Yeah.
But the text argues it's actually a lot more like a garden. It requires constant, exhausting maintenance, or it just gets overrun with weeds.
What's fascinating here is how the 2015 to 2029 period shattered that finish line illusion completely. It revealed that democracy is not this static achievement.
It's highly dynamic, right?
It's an incredibly vulnerable ecosystem. We saw established democracies, places that considered themselves entirely immune to backsliding, suddenly facing unprecedented internal pressure.
Polarization, economic uncertainty, just a massive breakdown of trust.
Exactly. And the focus had to shift from just celebrating the system to actively defending the mechanics of it. Because free elections alone obviously do not make a democracy.
Well, let's dig into those mechanics because
Yeah.
you can have millions of people casting ballots, but if the underlying architecture is rotting, those votes don't actually yield a healthy government.
That's spot on. The source explicitly lists the required structural pillars that have to remain intact. First, you need an independent judiciary.
To enforce the rules fairly, regardless of who is actually in power at the time.
Right. Second, you need a free and diverse press to act as an accountability mechanism. Third, you need a baseline of social trust.
Ooh, social trust. That feels like the hardest one to actually quantify,
It
right?
is, but it's arguably the most crucial. Social trust is the underlying belief that even if you completely disagree with your political opponent on policy, you both fundamentally want the nation to succeed.
You're still on the same team at the end of the day.
Exactly. And the fourth pillar, cementing all of this together, is active citizens. The system collapses if the population simply views themselves as passive consumers of government services.
They have to be active participants. But hold on. I want to push back on this a little bit because we are talking about the social trust breaking down, right?
Yeah.
But hasn't political spin always existed? Why did information suddenly become a strategic weapon during this specific period? This brings us to lesson 5 in the dossier.
It's a great question. Because you're right, propaganda is as old as human communication. The Romans were carving hit pieces into stone.
Right. So what changed? Did the digital age invent the anger or just organize it?
Well, the economic dislocation, wage stagnation, the feeling that globalization left entire regions behind, those were very real pre-existing domestic failures. But what happened between 2015 and 2029 was the digital revolution.
So it was the speed of it all.
Yes. Information now spreads faster, is manipulated easier, and is much harder to control. Those legitimate grievances were identified and systematically exploited using new technological tools.
So it's basically the difference between having a dry pile of leaves in your backyard, which is a problem you created yourself.
And someone else coming along with a flamethrower, yeah.
A highly targeted algorithmic flamethrower.
Exactly. Foreign actors and commercial interests weaponize the information ecosystem to target the very active citizens we just talked about.
The citizens needed to sustain the democracy. Wow.
By flooding the zone with contradictory information and deepfakes, they eroded that critical pillar of social trust. A population that cannot agree on a shared baseline of reality cannot effectively govern itself.
That's terrifying. So protecting a society now isn't just about guarding physical borders with tanks.
No, it requires media literacy, transparency, and digital resilience. It's about guarding the truth.
Okay, so that's the hacking of the minds. But if the mind of Europe was under attack by disinformation, its physical body was vulnerable too, right?
Very much so. Which brings us to the physical supply lines.
Yes, let's pivot to segment 2. Lesson 2 in the dossier focuses on the risks of economic dependency. And, I mean, the list of physical vulnerabilities mentioned in the text is just staggering.
It really touches every single aspect of daily life.
We're talking about energy, raw materials, critical technology, semiconductors, and even basic pharmaceuticals.
It was a profound realization of just how exposed the continent was.
It's basically like outsourcing your immune system to a neighbor you don't even get along with. You just hope they hand over the medicine when you get sick. Why did Europe do this?
Well, for decades, the primary goal was economic efficiency, getting things cheap and fast. If manufacturing a microchip was 30% cheaper in Asia, you offshored the production.
Because everyone assumed the global market was just an apolitical bazaar. Everyone wants to make money, so nobody is going to flip the tables.
Right. But that era proved that overdependence on external partners creates immense geopolitical vulnerability. When tensions spike, that efficiency instantly transforms into a weapon.
A highly optimized supply chain is great until a hostile state closes a border. Then it's a noose.
Exactly. And the critical shift in European thinking here was that strategic resilience must now equal, if not override, economic efficiency.
Which leads perfectly into lesson 4, because nothing pulled that noose tighter than the energy sector.
The ultimate wake-up call. The energy crisis triggered by the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Oh, man. If you are listening to this, think back to how that felt. Do you remember the sudden, just dizzying spike in inflation?
It felt like it happened overnight.
It really did. People were looking at utility bills, genuinely worrying about how to heat their homes. Major, century-old industries were talking about shutting down because gas prices had quintupled.
It wasn't just a recession. It was a systemic shock. And it forced a complete redefinition of how governments categorize energy.
Right, because before that, energy policy was just, what, a technocratic debate? Or an environmental thing about emissions.
Pretty much. But the dossier states clearly that energy policy is no longer just about turning on the lights or saving the planet. It is security policy, economic policy, and industrial policy all combined.
They are completely inseparable. If you don't control the power switch, you literally don't control your country.
Precisely. A nation that cannot guarantee its energy is strategically compromised on the world stage.
Okay, so once you realize your energy and your economy are totally vulnerable, you suddenly have to look at your defense capabilities too.
Naturally. You have to look at the ultimate backstop of national sovereignty.
Which brings us to lesson 3. Defense cannot be fully outsourced. And this addresses the whole post-Cold War hangover.
The peace dividend, as they called it.
Now, Europe essentially used the United States as a heavily armed, incredibly expensive bodyguard for decades. They shrank their own militaries to invest in social safety nets.
Which is a great strategy for domestic prosperity, assuming the bodyguard never leaves.
But what happens when the bodyguard starts questioning the contract? when the U.S. says, hey, we have issues in the Indo-Pacific, you need to secure your own neighborhood.
Well, the war in Ukraine and the intense debates over NATO's future proved this arrangement isn't a law of physics.
So did they conclude that NATO was obsolete? Because the sources are pretty balanced on this.
Oh, no, not at all. If we connect this to the bigger picture, alliances remain absolutely essential. Nobody was suggesting tearing up the NATO treaty.
Okay, good to clarify.
But the key lesson was that alliances cannot replace domestic capability. A treaty is just a piece of paper if you don't have the factories to back it up.
Right, you need actual artillery shells, drones, and armored vehicles.
Europe had to painfully relearn that military production, defense investments, and strategic planning are core non-negotiable responsibilities.
Yeah.
You can't just flip a switch and restart a dormant defense industry.
Because you lose the tooling, the skilled labor, the engineers. By the time you rebuild it, the war is lost.
Exactly. You cannot outsource your ultimate survival.
Wow. Okay, so we need to defend our borders and build our own weapons. But lesson 6 in the dossier takes a really fascinating turn because it talks about defending the environment.
Yes, the climate stability lesson.
And it frames it in such a weird way. It emphasizes political stability for climate policy. Why does the dossier link those two things so heavily? Why not just focus on better solar panels?
Because inventing a better solar panel in a lab is only step one. The energy transition is a multi-decade generational overhaul of the entire physical economy.
It's the biggest infrastructure project in human history, basically.
Exactly. And it requires hundreds of billions, if not trillions, of euros. But here is the unbending rule of economics. Risk paralyzes capital.
Ah, so private companies and massive pension funds won't invest if the rules keep changing.
Right. They won't build new green infrastructure if regulations constantly shift with every 4-year election cycle. They need administrative continuity.
So if climate policy is just a partisan football and one government creates green subsidies, but the next one tears them up,
the investors just walk away. The risk profile becomes too toxic.
That makes total sense. Climate goals aren't achieved by catchy, temporary political slogans. They require deep societal support and stable institutions.
You can't separate the health of the atmosphere from the health of the democratic system we talked about earlier.
So just to summarize this rather grim picture we've painted so far, we've got vulnerable democracies, fragile supply chains, massive energy shocks, and huge defense gaps.
It's a lot to deal with all at once.
It really is. So how does a continent actually fix this? Do we just build a giant economic fortress, lock the doors, and refuse to rely on anyone outside?
Well, the temptation for isolationism is always strong in a crisis. But the primary framework that emerged from this era is Lesson 8, the rise of strategic autonomy.
Strategic autonomy. That's a major buzzword in European policy circles, but it sounds kind of like a fancy way of saying total independence, right?
It does sound like that, but total independence in the modern world is a physical impossibility. You can't mine every critical mineral or grow every crop inside Europe.
So what does it actually mean, practically speaking?
Strategic autonomy does not mean total isolation or self-sufficiency. It means systematically reducing vulnerabilities and increasing your freedom of choice.
Okay, so not being backed into a corner where you have to compromise your security just to keep the lights on?
Exactly. It means producing your own critical raw materials and tech-like maintaining advanced semiconductor manufacturing so no one can hold you hostage.
But the moment you try to build that resilience, you hit a wall, right? Because you still need the raw lithium and cobalt from somewhere.
You do. You can't conjure elements out of thin air. Which leads us to Lesson 9, the value of reliable partners.
So it's not about being a lone wolf. It's about choosing the right pack to run with.
That's a great way to put it. We saw a profound shift from blind globalization trading with anyone, if the price is right, to friendshoring.
And the text mentions some specific countries here, right?
Yes. It highlights deepening ties with nations like Canada, Norway, Japan, and Australia.
Nations that share baseline democratic values and respect a rules-based order. So resilience comes from a trusted network, not isolation.
Exactly. But there's a paradox here, which is covered in Lesson 7, the necessity of international cooperation.
Because even if you have the most resilient, self-sufficient supply chains on Earth, you can't shoot a novel respiratory virus at border control.
Right. And you can't negotiate a trade deal with rising sea levels. The massive issues of this era, pandemics, climate change, cyber threats, Migration simply cannot be solved by one nation alone.
So international cooperation isn't a sign of weakness or surrendering sovereignty. It's a hard mathematical requirement for survival.
You have to ruthlessly protect your national vulnerabilities while simultaneously cooperating on a global scale. It's a very complex diplomatic dance.
It really is. And, you know, bringing all these practical lessons together reveals what might be the most profound change of all.
Yes, the shift in the European mindset itself.
Here's where it gets really interesting, folks, because Lesson 10 focuses on a new European maturity. The biggest shift wasn't military or economic, it was psychological.
It was a geopolitical coming-of-age story. For a long time, Europe operated almost like a privileged teenager, living in a secure neighborhood, relying on the U.S. for protection.
Complaining about the parents, but never actually taking responsibility for the mortgage.
Exactly. But between 2015 and 2029, Europe was forced to grow up. It had to accept total responsibility for its own future in a very dangerous world.
So what does this maturity actually look like in practice?
It manifests as brutal realism, abandoning wishful thinking about how the world should operate and dealing with how it actually operates.
So long-term planning, joint decision-making.
And investing in resilience out of realism, not pessimism. Recognizing that the cost of inaction is vastly higher than the cost of preparation.
The historical context the dossier places on this is just staggering. It compares this 2015 to 2029 window to massive historical pivots, like 1945.
Rebuilding from the ashes of total war.
Right, or 1989, the fall of the Berlin Wall.
The comparison holds immense weight because the stable international order is no longer guaranteed. Europe was forced to entirely rethink its place in a multipolar world.
Which brings us to the ultimate cliffhanger of the dossier. And the core question for you, the listener today, will Europe actually use these painful lessons to become permanently stronger and more self-reliant?
Or will the natural human tendency toward complacency creep back in?
Yeah. Will it fall back asleep and wait for the next massive crisis to reveal what's at stake? It's the defining question of the century.
It really is the difference between learning a structural lesson and just surviving a temporary stress test.
It's an amazing place to pause, and it perfectly sets the stage for where we are heading next time. Because next time, we are moving from the grand geopolitical chessboard into the actual minds of the players.
Yes, Chapter 19.
Chapter 19 is all about the psychology of power and leadership. It strips away the policy papers to ask the fundamental question, why do people actually follow leaders? What compels millions of individuals to hand over their agency to another human being?
It is the perfect counterbalance to today's analysis of structural systems.
But before we wrap up completely, I think there's a final thought we should leave everyone with.
There is. If you think back to how we redefine democracy today, not as a finish line, but as a continuous process that requires active citizens.
Right, the garden that needs tending.
Exactly. And if an entire continent is currently going through this historical coming of age, what is your personal role in this new era? Mm. Are you just a passenger observing these historical shifts through a screen? Or are you part of the vital daily maintenance required to keep the garden of democracy alive?